49 degrees. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Calling it evidence that Live Free or Die is alive in the Granite State, supporters of gay marriage yesterday celebrated a stunning vote in the New Hampshire House. An effort to repeal same-sex marriage failed by a wide margin. Both sides of this long debate say they believe this issue will come back, especially in the fall's elections. But at least for this year, a repeal bill will not go from the House to the Senate on crossover day next week. That's the time when legislation that does pass the House and Senate changes hands. The passionate debate and frenetic activity surrounding yesterday's gay marriage vote put a mid-session capstone on an intense year for the legislature. Other bills that touch on deeply held values have been up for votes as well, from the role of unions to contraception to abortion to parental control over public schools. Today in The Exchange, we wrap up this giant bundle of bills that's about to cross over from the House to the Senate, and the smaller bundle that the Senate will send to the House. And let's hear from you, too. What legislation has caught your attention this year? As crossover day approaches, where these bills change hands, which ones do you hope the other legislative body supports or defeats? Give us a call, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us your thoughts by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or send us your thoughts on our Facebook page. Our guests are Kevin Landrigan, political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua and for the lobbynh.com. And Kevin, yesterday was a busy day. I'm glad you're here. Thank you.
Glad to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome. Good to see you.
Hi. Good morning, Laura.
And also with us, Josh Rogers, NHPR State House reporter. And Josh, thanks for making the time.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and Josh, let's talk about that gay marriage vote in the House. What was it like over there at the State House?
It was an interesting day. The debate was basically confined to Republicans. Democrats, all but one, were ended up opposing the bill. And unlike some votes on this issue, the gallery was not full of partisans. The people supporting repeal had told the crowds to stay away, essentially, not to to potentially provoke Republicans to voting in a sort of visceral manner, kind of tribally on the issue. It was fascinating. I mean, there were 10 votes.
10 votes? Yeah. Now, wait, is that unusual?
Well, I mean, it's not typical, but it's not beyond the pale in terms of lots of amendments, reconsiderations, that kind of thing. And, we're talking about a topic on which I think, 7 Republicans supported when gay marriage became law. And in the end, around 100 opposed its repeal, and it really ran the gamut, and it was an interesting debate. One that it'll be interesting to see how this spills over into the fall about what this means about GOP attitudes towards this issue as we move into election season.
Well, and one quick question for you, Josh, and then I want Kevin your impressions too. Your story this morning said that the majority leader, the deputy majority leader in the House, also voted against repeal, right? So it wasn't just libertarian-minded Republicans.
Well, I mean, in the end, the final vote, yes, like those folks did. And so it wasn't simple. I mean, Representative David Bates, who was the key mover on this issue, said afterwards that one reason why it failed was, we have got a lot of libertarians. They're not really Republicans, which is interesting to actually hear this from Republicans. The majority whip, Peter Silva, was saying similar things after the votes. This is a criticism that has been made of some of the new lawmakers from Democrats. But Republicans are also saying, these guys aren't really with us. Marriage is defined as one man and one woman in the state Republican Party platform. And some of these folks were a bit agitated that so many GOP members were saying, well, we don't really care about that. And so in the end, when the die was cast, a lot of old line members and prominent members of Speaker O'Brien's leadership team ended up supporting killing the repeal. Speaker O'Brien didn't preside during this debate, so he could cast a vote. He chose not to speak, perhaps seeing that this wasn't going to be a good day for him. But it was interesting in the way that this was something that it hadn't been whipped by the speaker. He hadn't really leaned on people, but he had spoken at rallies out inside the State House. And, prior to becoming speaker, he was, one of the big faces opposing gay marriage. And this was a big win for people who support gay marriage and a tough day for social conservatives.
Well, and Kevin, your thoughts, too. And I wonder if you were surprised by this vote.
Yeah, I certainly was surprised, certainly by the magnitude of it. But that can really be explained by the dynamics of the debate. I mean, usually you have to buy a ticket to see the circus. But we got to see it for free yesterday. It was a really stunning devolution of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives. It's amazing to me that after 16 months on the most important seminal social issue before the legislature in this two-year session, that Republicans couldn't come together on a strategy. That's what caused this thing to fail miserably. You had, as Josh alluded to, you had the prime sponsor, David Bates, Wyndham Republican, who became enamored very late in the game to this idea of a non-binding referendum, to attach that to the repeal, and then scheduled the repeal to occur March 31st of 2013. And in that way, if it was a supermajority of people in a non-binding referendum who supported same-sex marriage, we could then repeal the repeal. Well, the next legislature could repeal it. As Josh said, the old-time Republicans hate that. Why? Because we have the most representative body in the country, one of the most representative bodies in the world. We're not a referendum state. A lot of these old-time Republicans view asking the voters for permission on issues a delegation of their authority and their power. And I don't think they want to draw attention to the fact that 400 representatives can't decide on an issue so important as this one, so we're going to ask the public's approval of it.
So, Kevin, are you saying it's the issue itself, or is it that it was the strategy was poorly executed?
The strategy was awfully executed. So the referendum failed 188 to 162. So then you're back to the original bill, which didn't even have civil unions in it for gay and lesbian couples who want to join together in the future.
Which the original proposals did have.
Correct. So you had a completely flawed bill that so many people, so many supporters of traditional marriage couldn't possibly support. I wasn't surprised this bill was in trouble because, as Josh alluded to, talking with a lot of rank-and-file backbench Republicans, many of them said to me publicly and privately, look, I support traditional marriage. Had I been in the legislature, I would have voted against this law. But these folks have been given rights. Don't ask me to take them away from them now.
The idea of repealing a right that's been on the books for 2 years.
Correct.
But Kevin's right, though. During the course of the debate, you could feel it was strange. I can't recall being observing a debate there where things just seemed to go from worse to worse, and you could feel people who might have been game to vote for a repeal just say, you know, let's just pull the plug on this thing and move on. And there were people saying, like, you know, we're going to be embarrassed here. This is going to end up on TV. This is crazy. And so it's hard to parse out exactly what it is. I mean, the supporters of same-sex marriage would say this vote hews pretty closely to the polling they've done, and that means that's what the public, that's what the officials think, like the public thinks. I'm not sure it's quite that, right. But taking people's rights away is something that is hard to do.
Well,
there's no
Dean,
doubt about
to you.
That.
Yeah, it's very interesting to hear both Kevin and Josh talk about the strategic failures among Republicans in the state legislature. You know, this issue of gay marriage has been a rallying point for social conservatives around the country for a long time. And as more and more state legislatures and state courts have moved to allow gay marriage, we're starting to see a movement towards these referenda. I think there's a sense among conservatives that their best bet is to take the issue to a vote of the citizens of the state. And as Kevin said, we're not typically a referendum-style state. You know, as Josh was mentioning, the larger context here, the larger trend in the polling data is really a generational one. If you look at polling data, you look at younger voters are typically very comfortable with the idea of gay marriage. You see more resistance among older voters. It doesn't so much break down along party lines. This is going to be a big issue for a long time to come in the sense that it mobilizes very conservative voters to at least to try to repeal, and those who support support it to try to protect it. But clearly, I think that the trend long term is moving towards an acceptance of same-sex marriage, and maybe kind of a little bit of the futility that you saw on the floor of the legislature yesterday reflected a sense among Republicans that, you know, this issue in some sense is slipping away from them, despite whatever strategic imperatives they might have at the moment.
Well, we're talking about crossover day today on The Exchange. Again, this is the day that's approaching next week when bills approved in the state House are passed to the Senate and vice versa. And clearly, to many people's surprise, including I think everybody in this room, a gay marriage repeal will not cross over from the House to the Senate. So, gentlemen, let's talk about some of the issues that will be crossing over in the form of bills. And just remind us, if you could, Kevin, this is the second year of the legislature, so the agenda and the bills are different from the first year.
Yeah, they are very different. The first year is dominated by the state budget. The second year is dominated really by ideological purity. And what do I mean by that? In whichever legislature is in charge, and now it's predominantly Republican, special interest groups on both ends of the spectrum aggressively push forward their agenda. It's mostly a social agenda, but sometimes it's a fiscal agenda. And they do that for election purposes. They want to put legislators on record on bills like right to work. That's an anti-union bill. On votes on the left, on votes like decriminalizing marijuana, that barely passed the House of Representatives by one vote. They all do this in order to, as I said, take the count and then mobilize. And by mobilize, I mean fight to support their friends, fight to defeat their enemies at the polls.
So the political tone, Dean, in the second year of any legislative session is different. Everybody's got an eye toward that fall election.
Yeah, that's a great way to explain it, I think. We've seen a number of these social issues bubbling up. In some sense, it mirrors the period that we had before the 2010 election and the rise of the Tea Party. In a sense that, if you have the majority in the legislature, you put forward an agenda that is going to mobilize your core partisans to turn out in the next election. And because this is a Republican legislature, we're seeing a certain set of issues that we probably would not have seen or did not see back when Democrats controlled the legislature before. So absolutely, there's always kind of an electoral incentive to shape your agenda in that second term, whereas, as Kevin mentioned, that first term really is focused more on kind of budgetary issues over the longer term.
Well, and coming up, we'll look at some of the bills that did pass and will go now from the House to the Senate, including two on these social issues you gentlemen mentioned, contraception and abortion. We'll start taking your calls, too. Join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Waste Management. With a reminder, new energy-efficient CFL bulbs contain mercury and need to be recycled properly. Details on bulb recycling at thinkgreenfromhome.com. And from Rothwangel Dental Care in Bedford, comprehensive family and cosmetic dentistry, devoted to restoring and enhancing the natural beauty of your smile. Information at rothwangeldentalcare.com. More on Crossover Day in the New Hampshire Legislature on The Exchange on NHPR and at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, a preview of arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court on the Affordable Care Act. New Hampshire weather today, mostly sunny, unseasonably warm again, highs from 80 to 88 degrees, with warmest temperatures likely across the southern part of the state. Tonight, partly cloudy, a chance of an isolated shower or thunderstorm, especially from the White Mountains and the Canadian border. Lows from 45 north, ranging 55 in the south. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's crossover time when both the House and Senate swap the bills they've each passed. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477 or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook. We hope you'll go to our page, join the conversation there. As crossover day approaches next week, again, with the House and Senate trade bills, which ones do you hope the other legislative body supports? Which ones do you hope the opposite legislative body defeats? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And before we go to our listeners, gentlemen, Josh, we mentioned just before the break that it's typical in this second year of the legislative session for a lot of social issues to come up. Boy, that was the case this year. We saw again the gay marriage repeal yesterday. The House talked a lot about contraception also this year. Josh, this is not an issue that I remember coming up in the many years that, you know, you and I have been watching this. How come we were talking about it this year?
Well, this was spurred by the controversy in Washington over the requirement under the federal health overhaul that all employers cover contraception for their employees. And that was objected to by religious groups, particularly the Catholic Church. The president crafted what he called a compromise, which was that insurers would be forced to pay, and it would not be something that would be a direct payment by the religious employer. Some religious people thought this was a fine compromise. Others thought this was absurd and was trampling on people's religious liberties. People of the State House, Speaker O'Brien became interested. New Hampshire has essentially had the same thing on our books since 2000. It was passed in 99 with a Republican legislature and Democratic governor, very bipartisan. In the 12 years that New Hampshire's contraception mandate, which simply says that all prescription drug plans must cover contraception, sort of a drug parity issue. It was believed to be discriminatory against women. Uncontroversial, bipartisan, no one's complained. The Catholic Church didn't complain. None of these religious organizations in the state that that were affected by this complained. Some of them were self-insured, which are not, therefore not, they can do what they choose.
Including the diocese.
Including the diocese. Speaker, introduced a late amendment and, is behind it four square and, cruised through the House and it's headed to the Senate. And it's, both a matter of, for them, it's a matter of religious liberty. It's another way to go after the health law. Republicans in Concord have been doing all they can to thwart the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. So it's a little bit of both.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit later about other efforts in the House that deal with the Affordable Care Act. But Kevin, your thoughts on this. Why now?
Well, I think it is about presidential politics. I hate to, kind of come back to the election motif, but it's irresistible. House Speaker Bill O'Brien, as much as any legislative leader I've ever seen and covered in the legislature for more than two decades, has aggressively embraced this mantle of a legislative leader who's going to go after the national agenda, the incumbent president's agenda. In states in a presidential year, the national committees, Republican and Democratic alike, send out bulletins to legislative leaders saying, here's what Obama's doing wrong, or here's what former President George W. Bush is doing wrong. Are you interested in taking on this issue? And on issue after issue after issue, Speaker O'Brien takes up that charge and aggressively fights it. And this is a very expansive exception on contraception. It doesn't just allow organizations and businesses that are owned by religious groups to exempt their health care plans from this mandate. It's for any employer who has a religious objection is not required to provide contraception in their health plan to their employees.
And it's not defined. It's open to broad interpretation. And critics of this say that for that reason, it would likely not stand if challenged, but it is wide open, as Kevin says.
Dean.
Yeah, and I've obviously approached it from a presidential issue as well. It's been kicking around the Republican primary for a long time. For me, what is most interesting to look at is this competitive framing of the issue. Republicans frame it as a religious issue. Democrats frame it as a civil rights issue, and that's going to be where the debate is fought. So clearly, Democrats think this is a winning issue for them. Republicans feel like they need to keep it on the on the surface as a religious freedom issue.
And one more question for you, Kevin, and I'm going to ask you guys this a lot this hour. What might the Senate do with this contraception mandate issue that they got from the House?
Well, Governor Lynch has not said he would definitely veto this bill, but we suspect he would, and that's going to dampen support in the state Senate. And many Republican senators I've talked to privately are very uncomfortable with this bill, are very worried about mobilizing women in both parties aggressively against this bill, pointing out, of course, that over in, 95% of Catholics, that the religion that opposes contraception, use contraception.
Yeah, and that number has been sort of bandied about and much debated. But I hear you that the Senate, you're saying that the Senate is worried about this as a political issue.
Yeah, they are very worried about it. I mean, they do have Governor Lynch as cover. I mean, it's quite possible, and I fully expect many Republicans to vote for this proposal, knowing the governor will bail them out by vetoing it and not being able to override that veto.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. We're wrapping up the many bills that will be crossed over next week on Crossover Day. That's where the House and Senate bills trade hands. Join us with your questions or comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. One more sort of hot button social issue bill, gentlemen, did pass the House, and Josh Rogers, a couple abortion bills. Now, next week, we're going to do a whole program on these abortion bills, so we won't talk a lot about it now. But as I understand, there is a couple abortion bills that passed the House and will go to the Senate, right?
Yes. I mean, the big one is the what proponents call the a woman's right to know bill. You know, it would require 24-hour wait for abortion, and it would require doctors and the penalty on this is up for debate, but it would require, as drafted, it would require doctors to provide women wanting to receive an abortion with health information that and, you know, potentially make available videotapes talking about fetal development, the risk of abortion, and if medical providers didn't properly do this, they could be, or willfully ignore this, they could be subject to a class A felony. And that felony provision caused the bill to go to a second committee after it passed the House. The House Criminal Justice Committee has voted to strip that out. It's going to head back to the floor next week. What happens there, we don't know. But surely this is a bill that it's the sort of thing that that hasn't traditionally gotten a great deal of traction in New Hampshire. And there are a lot of Republicans who think it goes too far and, you know, is a sign of a sort of a new breed of socially conservative lawmaker that's sort of out of keeping with what has traditionally been the GOP leadership style in Congress.
So, gentlemen, as we wrap up, again, a lot of these social issue agenda bills that have been debated, abortion, contraception, the gay marriage repeal that failed. Dean Spiliotis, I wonder, are there lots of national money groups playing a role in these legislative debates? I mean, we think we're an island, but there are big national organizations on all sides that come in and lend staff or lend money and so forth.
Absolutely. Even though we tend to think that this is just simply a state-level issue, the reality is that these very same issues are being fought out in state legislatures all around the country. We had that incredibly high-profile example in Virginia with the governor supporting an abortion bill that would require a particularly invasive sort of ultrasound before you could have an abortion. Once he realized what the actual procedure was, he backed away. Some people say he's looking to be vice president for Mitt Romney, a vice presidential nominee. Yes, these groups are absolutely involved. They provide money. They provide resources. As we've talked about before, the internet and technology provide a sort of a core mobilization tool for them. We've seen it in the gay marriage issue, and it'll be the same in the fall general election. We've talked about this in recent cycles, the amount of money coming in from these advocacy groups and the amount of resources being provided is quite significant. So we're absolutely not operating in a vacuum here. And it is fascinating when you look at that list of what we've talked about so far. It is right out of kind of the national ideological agenda that's being discussed right now in the presidential primary.
And what's really interesting is that one of the first rules in presidential politics is you don't play in the state politics sandbox. And what I mean by that is presidential campaigns don't want to be conflicted with what's going on in the state. Someone who votes for Ovid Lamontagne for governor may well vote for Barack Obama for president. So you don't want to mix the two. But the Obama campaign in just the last 10 days or so has decided that Speaker O'Brien's agenda to them is so toxic to women that they've launched an attack. They called it last week the Romney-O'Brien attack on women. They aggressively believe that they can mobilize women against Republicans up and down the ballot on this and other issues.
Well, and it's interesting because Speaker O'Brien, when I was talking to him about the contraception issue we were discussing earlier, he sees this whole issue as almost a conspiracy of the Democrats to draw Republicans to, as he put it, divide women, split women and Catholics and You know, basically to get to 51% of the vote is precisely what he said. And, you know, Kevin's right. The Democrats see this as an opportunity to mobilize women across the board. And, you know, they've recast the president and the DNC is recasting the Affordable Care Act as almost a women's health issue to try to build support and mobilize people to say, well, you know, repealing this law would do dire things to women's health. You know, women, you know, the president carried them by 13% last time, and you know, certainly Democrats up and down the ticket, it's a huge part of their base. And how this plays out moving forward, particularly as the Affordable Care Act goes before the Supreme Court next week, Republicans think that they can again recast the issue as, you know, government intrusion, but that push and pull is going on nationally, and it's surely going on at the State House. But as far as big money coming in the state, it's true on some issues, but on other issues, like, you know, sort of like, why pay for it if you can get it for free? Kind of.
Right. If they know they've got the momentum on their side, why bother? Go to another state where it's more hard fought. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. All of you mentioned the Affordable Care Act, and I do want to ask you about a couple health-related bills, but let's go to our listeners first. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can join us on Facebook as well. And Sean from Rochester is with us. Hi, Sean. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I know the bill recently passed the House for the decriminalization of marijuana, and it's up for vote in the Senate. I know Governor Lynch has said he'd veto it before. What is his stance on the bill this time? And do you think he'll veto it again?
Yeah, it's a good question, Sean. I'm glad he called, Kevin, because this was one vote in the New Hampshire House, right? Decriminalization passed by one vote.
Yes, it did. And Sean, very good question. And the answer is yes, he'd veto this bill as well. The bill that he threatened to veto in 2011, when the Democrats were in control of the legislature, would have decriminalized up to a quarter ounce of marijuana possession. This would double that to half an ounce of marijuana possession. And even some, such as Concord Democrat Steve Shirtless, retired Deputy U.S. Marshal, who has supported the smaller amount, said, wait a minute, this is just too much. This amounts to 20 to 30 joints. This could be some, you know, student trafficker in the playground with that much marijuana, peddling it to other children. I can't support that, and Governor Lynch will veto this. It will die in the state Senate.
Do you want to talk about why Dean Spiliotis, we kind of made a big headline, Speaker Bill O'Brien didn't vote here. He could have broken this. He could have made it a tie because it only won by one vote, but he decided not to jump in on that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Perhaps the Kevin or Josh will have some insight into his specific motivations. I will say that this is another one of those issues that is kind of very slowly trending throughout a number of different states. Whether you're talking about, you know, decriminalization, small amounts, there's a sense among law enforcement, some law enforcement around the country, that, you know, up to a certain level, it's kind of a waste of resources to be dealing with it. Medical marijuana, we've talked about as well. There are some states that now allow prescriptions. And you can use marijuana in those states only. So, yeah, this is one of those issues that has kind of slowly been moving along. The governor has traditionally opposed it. I agree with Kevin. I think, you know, he would veto this as well. In terms of O'Brien's specific motivations on this, perhaps Kevin or Josh might have some insight.
Well, I mean, I think he was trying to be sort of magnanimous and you know, perhaps a bit sort of puckish on the podium then. And also, you know, he needs to work with the folks in the House, and, you know, a lot of the folks that that wanted decriminalized marijuana within the Republican Party are the same folks that he's hoping to have on board on other issues. And certainly if he gets reelected and wants to become Speaker again, he's going to need their support. And he wanted their support on same-sex marriage repeal, for instance.
All right. Well, Sean, thanks for the call. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Again, as crossover day approaches, we're looking at all the bills that will trade hands. Which ones do you hope stay supported through this process, make it to the governor's desk? Which ones do you hope are defeated? Our number 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, you mentioned before, again, some of the bills we saw in the House and Senate had to do with the Affordable Care Act. And Kevin, I wanted to ask you about one of them. The New Hampshire House voted against New Hampshire setting up and running what's called a health insurance exchange. These are, it's been called sort of the Travelocity of healthcare. We can go online and shop around for different types of coverage that might fit your needs. Is the Senate going to take this up, or is this gone? Because from what I understand, the mandate is coming. You have to set these up by 2014, or the federal government will do it for you.
You do. We learned this week that New Hampshire is one of only two states in the country that is not going to get a not going to use planning grant money to set up a health care exchange. As you point out, the Affordable Care Act requires a health care exchange to serve any folks that get a taxpayer subsidy for their health care. So that's everyone on Medicaid. That's everyone on the Children's Health Insurance Program that isn't paying the entire premium themselves, and very few are. And the Affordable Care Act is very clear about this. If states, you don't set up a state health care exchange, then we'll set one up for you, and we'll run it at the federal level. That's one of the reasons why Governor Lynch in the State of the State speech called for creation of a state health care exchange so we can control the kind of program it is. Going back to the earlier election motif, House Speaker Bill O'Brien's dead set against the Affordable Care Act. He thinks it's very unpopular. And even in the polling, there's a lot of opposition to the Affordable Care Act. There's no question about that. And he doesn't want the state in any way getting involved in creating a state health exchange. This bill goes so far as to say to order the insurance commissioner in the state of New Hampshire not to cooperate with the Obama administration in any way if the federal government moves in to try and set up a health care
exchange.
So just
to super clarify, Kevin, this bill, which orders the state insurance department to not cooperate with the Affordable Care Act, that passed the House and it's going to the Senate.
That's correct. And in the Senate, there's been a lot of division on this issue already. Bedford Republican Ray White, who's in the insurance benefit business, authored his own bill to create a state health care exchange. Conservative groups mobilized against the Senate early on in this session. Americans for Prosperity, Cornerstone Action.
These are the national,
New Hampshire.
Some of the national groups.
Some of the national and some of the state groups as well. And pressured the state Senate to kill that bill. The bill ended up being tabled, and Senator White has acknowledged that that this state health care exchange could do devastating results to private insurance broker market. I mean, the Affordable Care Act dramatically increases the Medicaid population. Over time, it could go up in New Hampshire by as much as 50%. So that whole market would be controlled without a state health care exchange by a federal bureaucracy. That's why all the state health care insurance companies support a health care exchange, but I don't think the Senate would pass one.
All right. Well, and coming up, more of your calls, and also we have to hit a couple more big bills that were passed and will go to the Senate, including right to work, and we'll also talk about education funding and gambling, if we can get to that as well, gentlemen. Our number, 1-800-892-6477.
NHPR's March membership drive was a success. With the help of more than 4,500 listeners over the last 2 weeks, we've raised $450,000. In the coming weeks and months, we'll use that money to pay for
office supplies,
our Shifting the Balance series,
election coverage for later this year,
electricity bills,
special events like Ira Flato in Durham.
Thank you to all our members who helped to make this possible.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Pixel Media, now hiring interaction designers, information architects, .NET developers, and project managers. Details about Pixel Media's creative culture at pixelmedia.com. And from G2 Plus One, providing landscape architecture, site planning, and graphic services, located in Salisbury, New Hampshire. Mostly sunny, unseasonably warm today, highs from 80 to 88 degrees, warmest temperatures likely across southern areas of the state. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at Crossover Day, which is coming up. Again, that's where the House and Senate bills trade hands. Tell us which ones you hope the other legislative body supports, approves, sends to the governor's desk, and which bills do you hope the other legislative body defeats. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Josh Rogers, Kevin Landrigan, Dean Spiliotis, let's go right back to our listeners. And then I do want to ask you about that big right to work vote. Let's go to John in Amherst. Hi, John. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Laura.
Hi, John. You're on the air.
Thank you.
I just want to make a brief comment about religious liberty, which seems to be, you know, thought of as an absolute right, whether it's an employer or an individual. And a number of these cases have, you know, have been tried, and basically the view of the Supreme Court is that, you know, religious liberty has to be balanced against against individual liberties and against the rights of the community and of the majority. And it really bothers me when it seems to be treated that, you know, well, if somebody has a religious objection, that trumps everything, and it just doesn't.
There's two things to think about here, you're saying. There's two things to think about here, two issues to balance, Dean Spiliotis: religious liberty, individual liberty, and we're always debating which one's going to hold sway,
right,
aren't we?
And John is getting back to the comment I made earlier about the competitive framing of this issue. Conservatives really do believe that religious liberty trumps these other issues, and progressives and others and libertarians believe that, no, it's a question of civil rights and individual choice. You know, maybe there'll be, you know, maybe this will continue on in the courts in another version. But clearly, you know, each side sees this in a very different way. And you know, my sense from talking to both sides is, you know, Democrats see this as a winning issue for them, that they can make as the guys were saying, mobilize the gender gap here on this issue and also make it a civil rights issue. Planned Parenthood and even NARAL have been very active on this issue nationally. Conservatives want to make it a religious issue. I'm not so sure they've had as much success as they would have liked. I think they're a little bit on the defensive now from a strategic perspective. But that's how it's going to play out.
Well, and I want to switch gears a little bit from some of these social issues that we've talked about. And Josh Rogers, to Right to Work. Now, this came up last year, vetoed by the governor. Right to Work has to do with laws governing unions in the workplace. And as Kevin said earlier, Right to Work is seen as an anti-union bill. Why does this keep coming up, Josh? And are the dynamics any different this year than last year?
Well, it keeps coming up. I mean, it keeps on coming up a lot more lately than it has in the past. I mean, this is not a new issue. I mean, basically, what Right to Work laws would do would forbid unions from collecting payment from non-members to cover the costs of representation and collective bargaining and in the workplace.
That's how it is now. If I'm not a member of a union, I still have to pay a little bit to cover what unions would call the benefits that I have received from that collective bargaining.
Yes, because the unions represent you even if you're not a member. And so there are 24 states that have right to work laws. This has been moving nationally a little bit. I mean, Indiana enacted right to work recently. You know, New Hampshire passed it. The governor vetoed it. You know, the speaker, held off on the vote, wouldn't announce when it was going to be. You know, as we were talking earlier, you know, sort of dragged the presidential candidates into this and had them come to the House, address them. All of them said, you know, we need right to work in New Hampshire. The votes weren't there for an override. It's passed the House this year in a slightly different version. Based on the early votes, the votes aren't going to be there for an override. The governor says he's going to veto it. The unions are out in force against this, but this is not the only thing they're fighting against. There are a lot more bills that they say are going after them. There's the ideological argument about, you know, how a workplace should be ordered. There's, you know, but there's a lot of politics in this. Obviously, unions are powerful backers of Democratic candidates most of the time, and there's a lot of money, you know, coming at this on both sides. Many union lobbyists on the ground, barbecues on the state house lawn, that kind of thing, and many, you know, right to work advocates, you know, pumping money at candidates. And this will be interesting to see how this constellation of bills regarding collective bargaining and union benefits work itself out. A lot of this involves public sector employees, too, in New Hampshire.
So we're going to see pretty much what we saw last year, then. The House supports it. The Senate supports it. Lynch vetoes it. Same story, different year.
Looks that way.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, I want to ask you about another bill that Governor Lynch has seemed to really want to accomplish before he leaves office, and this is education funding and a constitutional amendment to ease some of the conditions under which our school funding system operates now under the so-called Claremont rulings. The Senate and the governor have gotten together on this. The House, not so much. What's going on there?
That's correct. The Senate got together with Governor Lynch, supported an amendment on education funding that would allow for more targeting to needy school districts than now exists. An important provision in that it essentially said the state continued to have a responsibility to assure an adequate education.
That amendment includes that word responsibility, and that's a sticking point for many in the House.
It really is. It's important to note that this was one of, on this issue already, this is one of Speaker O'Brien's signature achievements. I mean, no Speaker of the House since the Claremont decisions has ever gotten a constitutional amendment on education funding through the House. Speaker O'Brien did it, and the first time in more than 80 tries. But he did it without this word responsibility. And he did it in a way that gives the legislature full discretion in determining levels of funding for school districts. Governor Lynch felt that amendment without responsibility allows future legislatures to walk away. Last week, Speaker O'Brien, kind of in a moment of complete candor with us, with the reporters, essentially said, I don't have the votes to do this again. I need the Democrats on board. We all need to come together on an amendment that can satisfy us, can satisfy the governor, can satisfy the Senate president. This is an issue, the Speaker said, that we all agree about the themes. We all want the same goal. We just disagree on language now. Let's do the hard work and come together on language that we all can support.
Well, and I saw the headlines the day after you guys wrote about that. And Dean Spiliotis, not a headline usually associated with Speaker O'Brien. Democrats, I need your help. What do you think about that? I mean, does this even have a prayer?
hard to know. I think that we've seen that the issue of the wording has become a significant stumbling block for some kind of compromise. But, you know, there's always a possibility. It's interesting to me, you know, not only have we been talking about this issue, it seems like forever, pretty much since I've lived in the state. But even just in this last legislative session over the last year and a half or so, since the 2010 election, we've talked about, well, here's one area where everybody seems to be in agreement. Lynch wants to get something done. He's wanted to for a long time. O'Brien may be able to do it in a way that no one else has been able to. Yet they still don't seem to quite be there, and we're in risk of you know, bleeding into yet another election cycle where nothing's going to happen and Lynch is going to be out of office. Now, maybe if we end up with a Republican governor and a Republican legislature, it might even be a little bit easier, but there's no way to know for sure what's going to happen there. So this just seems to be a perennial issue. It really seemed like this might be one area. But what often happens is the politics and the animosity and the conflict on other issues can often sort of spoil the waters a little bit for compromise in a particular area. So I think, you know, it was interesting to see that candor that he does in fact need the votes. With all the other stuff going on and all the other areas of contention between the two parties, it could make it a little bit more difficult to just get some kind of compromise done.
Well, and so let's talk about leadership. You know, at the beginning of the session, there was much written, Dean Spiliotis, about Bill O'Brien and DJ Betancourt, the Speaker and the Majority Leader, about their leadership style. You know, tough, getting stuff through. What about this year? Has that leadership style been the same this year as it was in that first sort of heady days of the legislature? Do you want to jump in on that first, Josh?
Well, I mean, one thing that is interesting about that leadership style, and I'm sure Kevin would agree, is that of late, the great propensity to try to overturn work by committees. Traditionally, mm-hmm. bills go to committees make recommendations. Those committees are led by people appointed by leadership, and leadership tends to say, well, they're the committee that did the policy work. This is our position. Vote
for
it.
We respect the work you did. We respect your knowledge base, and so we're going to go with what you said.
But, I mean, on bill after bill of late, it's been, you know, here's an amendment to overturn a committee's work. We saw a few of those yesterday. And so, you know, that's not entirely uncommon as we get to a second year of a session. But of late, I think that has been something that's caused a little friction. And so that is one thing that has certainly stood out of late. I mean, on the same-sex marriage bill, I mean, I will say that the leadership, you know, stood down. I mean, by all accounts, they didn't twist.
Let people vote their conscience.
They didn't twist arms on that. And you know, so it's a mixed bag, but, you know, it's a fractious group in the House. And so It always is, and this group in particular is somewhat combustible.
But that's a great point, because you do get a lack of clarity with this issue between the committees and what the leadership wants to do in a way that you wouldn't traditionally have. So I think that was a good thing to point out.
Well, an example, Kevin, is the bill on whether local communities can establish one-year moratoria on new refugee resettlements. We did a whole program on this. The committee vote was 15-1 against. No, this is a bad idea. And I even said, I shouldn't have done this, I said on the year, I said, given the committee vote, this bill will likely die in the House. Lo and behold, I was wrong. The 15-1 vote by the committee was dismissed by the broader House, and this refugee bill passed.
It did, and the Speaker celebrated its passage. Manchester Mayor Ted Gatsis has been fighting with this issue, as we know, and as your program pointed out on this issue, and he was able to prevail. I think what we've seen with House Speaker Bill O'Brien and the leadership style is very different than you usually see in a legislative leader who first gets the gavel.
Speaking as someone who's covered the legislature for more than two decades.
The first goal for anybody who gets the gavel is to keep it. That's got to be the priority. What do I do in order to keep it 2 years going forward? This speaker has not governed at all that way. I give him credit. Philosophically in that regard. He feels strongly about issues. He's determined to use every ounce of his political capital while he's still there. There's a lot of speculation that if Republicans lose dozens of seats and are still in the majority, there'll be a serious challenge to Bill O'Brien as Speaker. He may not be here after this term. He may be able to survive. He's a very savvy politician. I would not count him out. But while he's here, he's going to try and accomplish everything. And if that means upsetting the apple cart and pushing a few committee chairs' noses out of joint, he's determined to do it.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that is the Tea Party ethos from 2010. We're seeing the same thing at the national level with Republican members of the House caucus in Congress refusing to agree with Speaker Boehner and saying, look, I didn't come here to get reelected. There are certain things I wanted to accomplish. If I get them done and get kicked out of office, so be it. And that's different than what you typically see in a politician. It happens occasionally. This seems to be the most recent iteration of it. And absolutely, the connection between what O'Brien has done, I'm looking at the list of things we've talked about today. This is the Republican presidential election right here, and it really is remarkable. I think Kevin mentioned earlier the way in which O'Brien has embraced these larger national issues, and so that is a little bit different.
All right, and another national issue that definitely hit the ground here in New Hampshire, and Josh Rogers took up a lot of oxygen so far this legislative year, is voter ID. There have been bills going back and forth. So what crosses over on crossover day, and where does it cross over from? I've lost track of where all these voter ID bills are.
Well, this issue is one that has been, you know, fought about for a long time. And when there are big partisan swings, election law issues come to the fore. And, you know, Republicans have been pushing for some sort of voter ID or verification system for some time. There are strong differences of opinion on whether there is, you know, voter fraud rampant or minimal in New Hampshire. A lot of conservatives believe that the authorities essentially turn a blind eye to examples of improper voting, and the Secretary of State's office and the Attorney General's office say, well, you know, there really aren't many of these, and so the law and the bill that is likely to have the strongest chance of becoming law is something sponsored by Senator Russ Prescott, which would ask people to a phased-in ID for voting, not simply a state-issued ID. A college ID would also work, and this would be phased in over a couple of years. But people would not be prohibited from voting without an ID for a few years. And that one has the support of the city and town clerks. It's strongly opposed by a lot of Democrats. It'll be an interesting one with the Secretary of State, the city and town clerks on board. When this gets to the governor, what he chooses to do.
Yeah.
There's another one that's also passed by the Senate that gets at the whole domicile and tying it to motor vehicle records, and that one is much more likely to be met with a veto and is a lot more hard line in its aspirations.
So that one comes from the Senate, and it's worth noting, Kevin, that a lot of the bills we've talked about this morning, almost all of them, came from the House over to the Senate. Why has the Senate been, I don't want to say less active, because I'm sure they're working over there, but
sure.
Why this massive amount of legislation from the House and relatively little from the Senate?
Well, as we've talked about, the House is very fractious, and with almost 400 members, they come up with a limitless number of ideas. The Senate, in both parties, has a lot of discipline on its members, has encouraged a lot of senators who feel strongly, for example, on these social issues, to go over and co-sponsor bills in the House. Don't sponsor them here. We don't want them starting here. I can't tell you a number of Republican senators who've said to me, thank God I'm not in the House. Or, thank God
really?
I don't have to vote on what's – and I hope that doesn't – this issue doesn't come to me or that doesn't come to me. But on voter ID, this has the potential to be a real signature achievement for the Republican-led legislature. I mean, they've been trying for more than 15 years to get voter ID. And this started in the Senate because of Senator Prescott, as Josh said. He really did yeoman's work after voter ID crashed – on the rocks last year. He met with the Secretary of State. He met with the town clerks. How can I get you to support that? Here's how. You allow everybody, even without an ID, to vote. That's the key change here. Those who don't have an ID would be able to sign a challenged voter affidavit attesting to their residency. The Secretary of State then, after the election, would actually send certified mail to those people at their address to confirm they are who they are.
So old-fashioned consensus building with stakeholders in this
process.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think it's going to be a bill difficult for Governor Lynch to veto, given it's got the support of Secretary of State Bill Gardner.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank all of you very much for coming in, filling us in on this. There's a lot more to talk about, which I'm sure we'll talk about as the session continues. Kevin Landrigan, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin Landrigan, political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua and for the LobbyNH.com. Dean Spiliotis, thanks for your time.
Sure. Thank you, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of NHPoliticalCapital.com. And Josh Rogers, thanks for your time.
You're welcome, Laura.
Josh Rogers, NHPR's State House reporter. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Ryan Lassard. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.